Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our second in our new series on Megillat Esther, Megillas Esther, the Book of Esther. So last week we began the Megillah. We began with a contextualization of the story. We talked about the 70 years of the prophecy of Jeremiah to the rebuilding of Temple Number 2 in the aftermath of the destruction of Temple Number 1, the miscalculations by King Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Ahasuerus himself, and then finally, many years after the Koresh, King Cyrus' proclamation, Pekida, the temple is finally rebuilt by Darius, son of Ahasuerus and Esther, under the auspices of Ezra and Nehemiah, famously Temple Number 2, Beit HaMikdash Number 2. But we said that in the story itself, we have a situation that relates so much to our present day, our matziv, the situation of the exile that we're in right now. Why do I say this? Because very simply, God does not appear anywhere in the text. That's very significant. Because Esther's name, the Megillah's name, means hidden. And this is a relationship that we find in the Megillah of what they call Hester Panim, where the face, the countenance, if you will, of God's visibility that manifests itself in this world in a very overt, magnificent, miraculous way, it's over. The Book of Esther brings us into a situation unique to the world at that moment and going forward to our world, where God is there in the cracks of the window, you see God appear, the details, the little things. We spoke last week, for example, how a person could theoretically ascribe what I believe to be an open miracle in our generation, the 1967 war. One could ascribe it to God, or you could say, you know, it was superior training and tactics and military genius that won the day. And yet, if you look historically, you ask, well, how many wars have ever been fought and won with a crushing Mike Tyson-like knockout punch in 6 days? They say, well, none. How about 6 weeks? None. How about 6 months? Right? And you keep going, and you say, well, how about like the 100-year war? 200, right? You have wars that literally they have no end. So you say, well, what about 6 days? What do you think? And they say, well, you know, it was one day, Israeli, Sharon. You say, come on, please. Yes, I grant you. Israel did its hishtadut. It did its maximum to prepare for the day. Absolutely. Brilliant first strike against the Egyptian Air Force. Absolutely. But come on, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the day, what was 67? It's amazing. It's a miracle, right? This is Purim. Because when you look at the reality of our story from beginning to end, the manifestation of God's work is deliberately not there overtly, but covertly within the confines of this beautiful text that we call the Megillah. And when you take all the disparate parts that had to come to play, and all of them are amazingly put into play by a man named Mr. Preparation, it's hysterical, right? It's such an irony that Haman is called Mr. Mumuchan, which means Mr. Preparation. We said that we were familiar with the term Muchan Hachana, Hinenei Mimuchan Umuzuman, we say on Passover at the Seder, we're ready to do things. Nobody prepared better than Haman. The only problem was everything he prepared was, shall we say, Venahapachu. It was backfired and used against him by God. God said, Todah Rabbah Yashakoch, Mr. Haman, nice hat, by the way. Maybe we'll name a cookie after you. And then he said, nice job, because I'm going to use what you did and enact your own downfall piece by piece. So the magnificence of the story really only comes to bear in retrospect, which is, I think, the way we look at our world today. We don't often see the miraculous things that are around us in the real time, in the Jack Bauer 24-hour, you know, real-time clock, like in 24. We see it more often in retrospect. I just think that's the reality of our world. But nevertheless, it's there. And I think a knowing, thinking person sees it, is sensitive to it. And that's perhaps why this holiday uniquely has such a popularity among us, because it's a great story on the children's level, but it's a great story when you begin to take the pieces apart. We said last week that this is most definitely not a children's tale, that it's really, if anything, an R-rated, almost an X-rated story that we kind of dress down, or on Purim we dress up, and we kind of ignore some of the details that are a little bit horrific. We mentioned last week, for example, the nightmarish vision of the beauty contest and dressing your little girl up, you know, little Sarala up in the beauty contest, and she goes to play, you know, Queen Esther, and it's all great. And the Talmud does not paint such a nice picture. It talks essentially about a state-sponsored rape fest, where these poor girls were abducted for their beauty, taken against their will. They were given one night with the queen, with the king, the queen, yeah, sure. The queen, that was in a separate issue. They're given one night with the king, and if the king doesn't like them, doesn't ask for them by name again, they're essentially thrown in to be concubines in his harem. That's their fate. That's it. It's over. It's a horrible thing, right? But, of course, we just don't talk about it because it's not very nice. We don't talk. We color code the idea that poor Esther is married. They're not just cousins. Not uncle and niece, by the way. They're cousins. But they're not just cousins, they're married according to the Talmud. Mordechai and Esther are married. And yet, because she is taken against her will, it's rape. So she still is ostensibly permitted to her husband. At the moment where he says to Esther, you gotta go to the king willingly, the famous scene where he has been sequestered for a month now without even paying any notice to his queen. She says, well, but if he doesn't lift up the scepter, there's this crazy edict that even the queen loses her head if he tries to get access to the king. Right? This is all Haman's plan, that no one gets access to the king to try to revoke the edict against the Jews. So I lose everything. But she says, kasher avadati avadati. But if I lose, I lose. Right? What I've lost, I've lost. So some say that that is an allusion to her relationship with Mordechai. She says, you know, you're asking me to go to him, not as a case of rape. And if I go to him willingly as an eshet ish, as a married woman, I'm forbidden to you by Jewish law forever. I will never be married with you. And so it's over. So that's the enormous sacrifice. That even after the hoopla of our story is gone and the 10th chapter is done and we're singing Shoshanas Yaakov, we're leaving Esther out in left field because she still has to live the rest of her life married to the nefarious Ahasuerus. Now, we don't talk about that because it's not very pleasant, but that's the reality. Yes, Sion.
I didn't know that she was married to Mordechai. I thought he has adopted her.
He did, but he did marry her.
Well, yeah. I didn't know that.
No. Okay. No, it's Tor Shebaal Peh. It's not common knowledge. Oh. That's why we're here tonight, to get the uncommon knowledge. Okay, so we left off where Vashti has been dispatched. Doesn't say that she was killed, but, you know, obviously if she's just sent up to Devil's Island somewhere, how come the king can't retrieve her? He can't retrieve her, right? So it's a little bit like what happened to Ceausescu, you know? We don't know where you're buried, but you're like with Jimmy Hoffa somewhere under Giant Stadium, you know? We don't know. So she's buried under Giant Stadium somewhere. We're not sure where she is. Then the idea comes, hey, let's just have a big rape fest and get all the gorgeous girls, bring them to Shushan. And, you know, maybe you'll find somebody you like. Don't worry about yichus. Don't worry about genealogy. You're the king, after all. And then the magnificent Esther is taken, and she does something that nobody else does. And that's where we are tonight, in the second chapter. Okay? And I'm just going to touch on little tiny things. We are introduced to Mordechai and Esther in the fifth verse, Pasuk Hey, of the second chapter, right? And it's actually underlined, because this is one of the verses that before the Megillah reader reads it, we as the audience has to say it out loud. It's one of the four verses. Ish Yehudi Hayav Shushan HaBira, right? There was this Ish Yehudi, which literally means a man of Judah. Not a Jewish man, but a man of Judah in Shushan, the capital city. Ushmo Mardechai. And his name was Mardechai. Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Ish Yemini. The son of all these people, grandson, who was an Ish Yemini, a man of Benjamin. So the only problem with that is that how can you be both a man of Benjamin and a man of Judah at the same time? Now remember, this is not a small issue. There are 12 tribes of Israel. They were not always friendly to each other, to the point where there was an actual war fought against the people of Benjamin. And the entire tribe of Benjamin was almost exterminated for a horrific crime where a concubine called Pelegish Begiva, a very famous, horrific story in the Book of Judges, where she was raped, and almost like the story what happened to the daughter, you know, with Lot and the angels, where they threatened to, you know, dismantle the strangers, and then he fights, you know, against them, and the whole cities of Sodom are lost. Very similar story. So Benjamin was of the smallest tribe numerically. So this man really is the first Jewish person in history. Because until this point, you didn't call somebody an Ish Yehudi unless you were from Judah. Otherwise, you get a slap in the face, right? If he's from Shimon or Levi or whatever, they'd say, wait a minute, I'm not an Ish Yehudi. So clearly, he's being identified both as a Jew, meaning a man of the masses of the tribe of Judah, and also a Benjaminite at the same time. So he's uniquely outfitted for this. And of course, who is Mordechai? Goes on to tell us that he was part of the Galut, part of this exile. He was one of the great members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the 120 rabbi assembly that did a whole lot of proclamations and edicts that shaped the oral tradition that we have today. And then it says in Pasuk Zion in number 7, and
Vayihi omen et Hadassa. And he had raised this young orphan girl named Hadassa.
Right.
Now, who is Hadassa? Well, you may know her, it says. He Esther. She's known by another name. He Esther bat Dodo. Esther, who was his uncle's daughter. So if you do the calculation, your uncle's daughter is not your niece. It's your cousin. They're first cousins. Okay? That's why everyone seems to think somehow their uncle and niece. Everyone thinks that. Right. Right. It's a taut. It's a mistake. Ki ein la avein, because she had no father or mother. She was orphaned. Right? Vahanara. Now we describe the lovely, gracious Hadassa slash Esther. The young lady was a yifat to'ar v'tovat mareh. She was both beautiful of shape, form, and tovat mareh. Very beautiful to look at, which is a very big thing. Not too many women in Tanakh are ever given both monikers. In fact, Rachel is one of the first ever to be described in both ways. So she was extremely, extremely
Sir
lovely.
Sir wasn't?
I don't know if she was both.
She was yifat
to'ar. Yeah, exactly. Now, let's just step back for a second. So Esther is really Hadassah. Hadassah is Esther. Now, we all know what Hadassim are, because they're one of the four components of the Arba Minim, the four species that we shake, the Lulav Etrog. Hadass is the myrtle. And it's very beautiful, sweet, fragrant smell. A lot of people use the myrtles crushed up as besamim for Havdalah on Motzei Shabbat, at the end of Shabbat. Mm-hmm. So she's called Hadassah, according to many of the rabbis, because her actions were very beautiful, sweet-smelling to God. Hadassim are also what color? Green. So the Gemara actually has a little play on her and calls her Yok Yeroket, that she had like this greenish tinge, like an olive, Mediterranean, lovely complexion. She clearly was not blonde and blue-eyed with blonde hair. She was more Mediterranean-looking. It's very germane, as we'll see in a moment. But they called her Esther, which of course means hidden, which we said is both a play on her own tzivui, command, at the behest of Mordechai to hide her identity, her Jewishness from the king. That's obviously a big part of it. But more importantly, that Esther means it's a metaphor for God's relationship with the Jewish people, that he's hidden from them at this point in time, as we said a little earlier. Okay? And then he goes on to tell us that she was taken to the palace, and in verse number 9, Vatitav hana'arav einav, that the young girl, Esther, was pleasing in his eyes, Vatisa chesed lefanav, and she obtained his kindness. And then it talks about how she prepared, and they offered her all these different ointments, spices. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. We're going to go vital. We're going to skip through this, okay? And then go to number 17, Yud Zayin. It says, Vayehav ha-melech et Esther mikol hanashim. The king, Ahasuerus, loved Esther more than all the other thousands and thousands of young ladies that were brought to him. Vatisachen v'chesed lefanav mikol habitulot. For she found favor and kindness before him from more than all the virgins. Okay, I mean, here's the word virgin. I don't even know if they translate. They don't even translate it correctly. They say all the other girls. Well, the word bitula means a little virginal girl, right? So, there is a little, should we say, not a very nice overtone there. And then it says, v'yasem keter machut birashas. He takes the crown that was Vashti, and he places it upon her head. She becomes a new queen. Okay, let's talk about Esther. It says that she found favor in the eyes of everybody. Now, how is this possible? Now, we all know that in the old days, and let's harken back to the Olympic Games, pre the USA, USA chant. Remember before that time? The Olympics were like an oddity, where every 4 years, you saw athletes from countries that, oh, I don't know, where are they from, right? They're from nowhere. A little girl named Nadia or Olga or something, right? A little piddling girl. All of a sudden, she's doing amazing athletic endeavor, and the whole world falls in love with this person. They're like, oh my gosh, did it matter that she's from a little country called Romania? I don't even think most Americans could find Romania on a map, right? But they fell in love with her because it's like the epitome, the pinnacle of success. So we cheered for her. But once it became territorial, no, I'm not interested in Nadia. I want to know, how's the American girl doing? Or how's the English girl doing? Or how's, you know? Then it becomes a problem, because then it's no longer the purity of the sport. Then it becomes just my girl, and it's like, if it's not my girl, I'm not interested. I tune out, right? And that became, sadly, I think, the experience as the ratings from the Olympics grew. But once upon a time, believe it or not, there was a sense that, you know, the Olympic athlete was just, it was pure, you know? It was pure. Okay. Now, how does this relate? I believe it relates very profoundly. Because if the new queen is identifiably a member of a certain community or a country or a state, then there is that tendency of, gee, if she's not mine, Then her Rasmus and poll numbers plummet, right? Now, if she's from Hodu, she's in India, or she's from Ethiopia, from Kush, everyone loves her as long as you're East Indian, right? Not so good for everybody else. But Esther's skin tone and her ability to hide who she really is from everybody gave everyone the illusion that she's Mother Persia. She's from anywhere. She could be mine. So in the hearts and minds of all the people, she's like the ultimate Olympic athlete who's the best. And yet, maybe secretly she's like one of ours. Maybe she's a Canadian. Oh, yeah. Go, Esther, you know? And everyone's kind of silently rooting for her. There's no Kina and Sina. There's no, you know, there's no feelings of animosity and jealousy because she's one of yours. How could you not love her? So she not only replaces Vashti, but she identifiably becomes like the Mother Persia image, illusion to all the Persians. Now, this is not a small issue. And I've read this, I'm quoting from Rabbi David Foreman's book, because it puts her in a very awkward situation when she's called upon in a few chapters to say, guess who I am? I'm a Jewess. And this is who I am. This is my people. It's not so easy for her. Everyone thinks, oh, you just go into the king, right? You're the queen. No. She's the queen, yes. But conditionally, the thing that made her so attractive is her kind of ability to be Miss Anonymous. Once she identifies as someone, the allure is off. Maybe the king's not so happy. Maybe the population's not so happy. So it's a very big issue. I really believe this. So her ability to engender this love in the popular poll numbers is because everyone thinks she's one of ours. And even the king, in fact, Rabbi Foreman discusses, like, how could it be that he doesn't try to pin her down? You know, how many times can she say, like, could she giggle and not answer his question? You know, tell me, Esther, my dear, where are you from? Right? And she kind of just giggles, right? Then at some point, the king might just say, you know, Esther, enough with the giggle. I'm asking you a straight out question. Where are you from? At that?
Not if you want to.
Right, but you know what I'm saying. That's, Philip, at some point, though.
Because he could say to himself, you know, I don't really want to.
Very well said. But, you know.
Because this looks pretty good.
Right, right. Exactly. So there's no question that she engenders a unique relationship with everyone who, they just fall in love with her, you know? And part of it is the skin color and complexion. I mean, it's the allure that she kind of looks like everybody. So therefore, she could be your daughter. And if she could be your daughter, then she's loved. So that's terrific for Esther. Okay?
Now, she also just blessed with this grace that the Hashem gave her, that
absolutely.
People looked at her and liked her.
Absolutely.
A certain charm.
Yeah, she had a chen.
A certain likability.
No. She had an off-the-charts, like, thank you, Evanson. She had an off-the-charts likability factor, which was huge. Now, the fact that she does not ask for zero. She literally, not even Coke zero. She asks for FS. Nothing. Famously, the king is like, wait a minute, I got to give you something. How about half the world? Is that okay? No, I don't want, right? Because he loves her and he wants to do something for her, right? What have I given you? Nothing. Does she ask for example, all the other girls request myriad of personal servants and they do the oils. It goes through like literally verses of all the oils and the perfumes. They anoint themselves to go to the king. You got to prepare. You only got one night with the king, so you got to make a good impact. So they get months of like lavish preparation. Esther, what do you want? Nothing. What do you mean? I'm just going to go as who I am. I have nothing to hide. This is who I am. Except for my name and my job, but that's another point. Right? I'm just going in who I am. And it blows everyone's mind, right? Because how could this little girl go in with nothing, just who she is? What? No pretense? That's Esther. That's the remarkable nature of who Esther is. She doesn't ask for anything. And then when she asks at the most critical, perfect time, as we'll see. Okay? Let's go weiter, as they say. Okay? At the end of chapter 2, verse 21, Chafalah. We have a very short little three verses that are very, very germane to the story. We have these two buffoons, or at least they're portrayed that way in all the plays I've ever seen about Purim, called Bigson and Seresh. And these are two guards of the king's gate, right? I'll read the words very quickly. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, because he used to go every day in and day out, to check on Esther, make sure that she was doing okay for years, right? Bigson and Seresh, two of the king's chamberlains of the guardians of the threshold, I love the description, right, became angry and planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. They were not happy. They had to stand all day, and the Jew Mordecai gets to sit, according to some of the rabbis. They're very angry. Angry men. The plot became known to Mordecai, who told it to Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. The matter was investigated, right? Columbo and Rockford was put on the case. It was corroborated, and they were both hanged on a gallows. Gallows are a big thing for this story. It was recorded in the Book of Chronicles, the Guinness Book of World Records. It was recorded there in the king's presence. No reward. Forgotten. Boom. Coincidence, of course, right? Okay. Now, what happened with Big Sinister? It's a very cute little sort of a little tangential point. How did Mordechai happen to overhear Vixen Asertia? Is it like one of those, remember like Dallas or Dynasty in the Operas where the bad person, usually a woman, is always waiting, you know, like by the door, and she's always eavesdropping at the moment that the bit of information is brought in the room, right? Just waiting by the door, you know what I'm talking about, right? So like it's a little kind of coincidental that Mordechai happens to, you know, be walking by and Vixen Asertia. So the Chazal say, no, it's very simple what happened. Vixen Asertia spoke an arcane language that there was no one, to their knowledge, that ever spoke this language called Tarshish. You speak Tarshish? I don't, the Kaddish, I don't think it's in Tarshish, right? It's Aramaic. Tarshish, right? Tarshish, oh my gosh. So they're speaking in fluent Tarshish. And there are no subtitles, right? And they're plotting and they're, you know, having them back and forth. And Mordechai's sitting there with his little Gemara, learning or davening. All right. Happens to be, though, remember I mentioned you, Mordechai's a member of the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah. Guess what? You don't become a member unless you're fluent in 70 languages. Why? Because in order to understand a decision in Jewish law that could mean a person's life, you had to be fluent in the 70 languages, the 70 approaches to learning Torah, which means you have to be very, very much in line with every possible ramification of every possible idea as a court judge. So he had to be somewhat fluent. He had, I guess, the Rosetta Stone Tarshish version, and he knew it really, really well. So he hears them plotting in Tarshish. Boom! It's English or Persian to him, Hebrew to him. So right away he goes and translates it to Esther, says, Esther, you got a problem here. And right, so it's kind of fun. So you see that the own skill of his training actually helps Mordechai at this moment. And of course, the king does not reward Mordechai. It's nothing. He just tucks it away in the Book of Records, forgotten until a night where maybe Haman comes a little later and needs something from the king and the king can't sleep. Remember? So this is a delightful part of her story, which I have to just talk about for a moment. The Nahapachu. The Nahapachu is such a part of our story that we have songs that we sing. Right? Vinahapachu. And the turnaround, the turnabout. Because we said at the outset that Mr. Haman is described to us as Mr. Memuchan until the third chapter when he's actually called Haman. Mr. Preparation. So he's prepared according to the Gemara. It says, Muchan lefuranut. He's prepared to take a fall. And God is going to take all of his energy, everything that he does, all the plotting, and he's going to say, Yashar kochecha, thank you, Todah, Rabbah, thank you very much, Mr. Haman. I'll use all that you have prepared, but I'm going to use it to destroy you. So the rabbis are essentially saying that Haman could have plotted anything he wanted to. But in the end, he was dead. I mean, there's a famous joke where Haman is worried about his future. And of course, we know from the lottery that he's interested in like the supernatural and in chance, because that's the whole nature of the lots. The whole holiday is called lottery, after all. And he goes to the famous Madame Zushka, right? Fortune teller from behind the Iron Curtain. Or pretend that there was an Iron Curtain. And Haman plunks down his money and he says, Madame Zushka, I need your advice. Tell me about my future. So she looks into her crystal ball. She says, Haman, I can see that you're destined to die on a famous Jewish holiday. So Haman knows a lot about Judaism because he was really bright. He's a Malek. He has to. So he says, well, is it Passover? Is it Shavuot? Is it Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, right? No, she says. None of the above. Well, which Jewish holiday will I die on? Madame Zushka says, Haman, whenever you're going to die will become a famous Jewish holiday.
When Esther goes to the king to tell him that she learned from Mordechai about the two plotters, it doesn't say that there was a risk in her life going at that point to the king.
No, not at all. Because he was not sequestered yet. He was not this mad king. That will happen subsequent to Haman getting the letter sent out in the name of the king. At that point, Haman is a paranoid lunatic because the Jews are going to get to the king and change the verdict. So he's got to isolate the king from reachability factor, right? So that's the plot that happens a little later, right? So the point of that joke, though, it's a cute story, but it really is true, meaning God says, look, Haman, you know, there's going to be a holiday called Purim, but it's going to be whenever you die, whenever it is. So it's variable. It's up to you. You decide. It's good. 13th of Adar could be that, right? It didn't matter. That's the whole point, right? That's the whole joke, is that here he thought it was all coincidence. And God says, okay, we'll have it your way. Now, that's the ultimate irony, is that the Amalekites believe in Mikra, coincidence, chance. That's why we're rolling the dice to find the day and the month. Let's kill the Jews. And yet, God takes all these coincidental events, transports them into play, and affects their usage to destroy Haman. So it's almost like a very playful thing when you step back into Megillah, right, and the enormity of the potential Holocaust factor, which is not a joke, and say, well, but wait a minute, all those things that happened, like just for instance, okay, the fact that there's no reward for Mordechai at this moment, but at the very moment the king can't sleep and he asks for the book of records to be read and he gets to the verse of Big Son of Zeresh's plot, Haman's tiptoeing outside to ask him to build the gallows, which of course he's going to be hanged upon. He says to the king, by the way, in the presence of Vashti, we did not mention this last week, so it's brand new, I don't know what to do with the queen. I have to go to my counselors. You know, Vashti, it's a problem. I got to go to the Senate, and the Congress. Oh, yeah, they're giving me such a hard time passing anything through those nut jobs, you know. And then Haman says, well, wait a minute. You have a line item veto. So Ahasuerus, he's drunk, right? So he's not quite, she's line item veto. What do you mean? Well, you're the king. You don't need to go to the Congress and the Senate. Just say, off with her head. It shall be done. He goes, really? And you go, Brenner did this as Pharaoh. I didn't know I had the power. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So shall be written, so shall be done. Just say it. It'll be done. Royal decree, right? Okay. Really, I can do this? Haman says, absolutely. Okay. Off with her head, right? Guards come, they take her away, she's dead. Wow. Now, you know what the ultimate irony is? There's only one other person in the history of Persia that ever lost his or her head in that same way. Can you guess who that was? Haman. He's at the end of the story, and he's angry. He says, what do I do, right? And at that moment, he realizes, wait a minute. Charvona says, hey, look, there's the gallows outside, right? Gallows built by Haman, the enemy. And he wants to hang Mordechai, who you just remembered saved your life. You know Mordechai's on your team now. And he's thinking, you know, it's all, you can imagine the king going through all the machinations. And he says, you know, gee, I remember. Oh my gosh, it was Haman himself who said, I have the power. I don't need to get Congress's approval. Take him away. And they put the bag over his head. He's dead. So that it's such an irony, right? That here he's the one who gives the king the power to do this against Vashti. And he's the only beneficiary recipient of that same edict. It's hysterical. It's hysterical, right? But that's the point, is that the story is meant to illustrate the just the joke of this idea that the world just works on a roll of dice. We're not here b'mikra, coincidentally. We're here of a miraculous intervention of God. And the fact that we don't see it, okay, great. But maybe we'll see it in the details. When you take all the details together, they work, right? And I think it's a very beautiful idea. I hope that you'll appreciate it. Let's go quickly. I have just a few more minutes. And I want to begin with Perek Gimel, because we need our groggers tonight, okay? So the third chapter. So after Big Son of Zeresh are taken away and hanged, says Achar Hadvarim Ha'ela, after all these matters happened, get the groggers ready. Gidal HaMelech Achashverosh Es Haman. Woo, right? And this is the real Haman's mention, because we mentioned his entire genealogy. Look at his genealogy. Ben Hamadasa, the son of Hamadasa. Ha'agagi, the Agagite. Vayinaseu. And he literally lifted him up. He elevated him. He promoted him. Talk about a big-time promotion. Vayasem es kiso. He placed his kise, his throne, his chair, his office. Me'al, from above, even higher. Kol hasarim asherito. All of the officers are with him. So at this point, the king invests his entire kingdom in the vision of the Haman. Now, Haman was the one who, of course, got rid of Vashti. So he already began the investment process in the bank of Haman at that point. But here, it's an all right, just all-round investment. Haman's the man. You're the man. There's no one else who counts. And Haman has a special little, fun little proclamation, right? Listen to this in number two, which is really the cause and effect of the entire story. v'chol avdei hamelech, and all the servants of the king, asher b'shar hamelech, who were in the gates of the king, korim u'mishtachavim, just like in, we say in the Aleinu, v'anachnu korim u'mishtachavim u'modim. They had to abandon, bow l'haman, to Haman, ki chein tzival lo hamelech, because that is what the king had commanded concerning him, which is not really true, it's a lie. But whatever, we'll discuss another night. U'mordechai, but in contrast to the others who all bent and bowed, no. Lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. He refused to bend and bow. So the others said, Vayamru, avdei hamelech, huh? The others said, what's going on? The king's servant said, I don't understand, Mr. Mordechai, Rabbi Mordechai. They said to Madua ata over, why do you transgress Eis mitzvah hamelech? The direct command of the king, which really wasn't a direct command of the king, but that's besides the point. And then it goes on to say that they told him this day after day, and he didn't listen to them. Meaning Mordechai just said, I'm not bowing to Haman. So finally they told Haman what happened. Vayigidu l'Haman, in the middle of the fourth verse. So they finally came and told Haman, oh my gosh. They told him, Liraos hayamdu divrei Mordechai, whether Mordechai's words would avail, whether they would go on, because he saw that Mordechai did not bow to Haman because he was a Jew. They told him that he was a Yehudi, a Jew. So when Haman himself, I'm just reading in English, number 5, when he himself saw that Mordechai did not bow down to him and prostrate himself before him, then Haman was filled with rage, with ketzev, chema. That's when he was really, really angry. Right? But he said, wait a minute. I can't just kill Mordechai. This is a stunning idea. Nobody thinks about this. Why couldn't he just say, okay, off his head, he transgressed the law of the king, I kill him, right? No. Vayivez ba'ena. It was a bezoyan. It was like disgraceful in the eyes of Haman. It was beneath his office, his station. Lishlach yad b'Mordechai levada, that he should only extend his hand to kill Mordechai alone. Ki yigidu lo es am Mordechai. For they had also made known to him the people of Mordechai, us, the Jews. Vayivakesh Haman. Lahashmid, so then he wanted to destroy, basically Holocaust, kill them all. Es kol ayudim asher b'chol malfus achashverosh. He wants to wipe out all the Jews. Am Mordechai, the nation of Mordechai. So you know it's a nice Hitlerian thought. Look, got one guy I'm angry at, so let's just kill them all, right? Very logical. Okay, let's step back for a moment and talk about Haman, and then we'll end for tonight. Haman is described to us as an Agagite. So we said last week briefly that who was Agag? Why are we connecting him with some guy that is like a footnote in Samuel book number 1 history? Who is Agag? Well, interestingly, he was a king of the Amalekites in the time of, can you guess, King Saul. Now why that is germane to our story is that because King Saul doesn't kill Agag the day that he's given their mitzvah to annihilate all of the Amalekites, everyone, men, women, children, animals. And he is too worried about his PR and his Rasmussen numbers on the polls that people say, wait a minute, you can't kill all the animals. What? We need them. What do the animals do? Right? So he lets the animals live. Samuel the prophet comes to him and he says, ah, I'm so glad you're here, Shmuel HaNavi. I did exactly what God said I should do. And of course, Samuel hears the bleeding of the sheep and says, really? How come I hear like sheep and animals? Did you go to war with your sheep and animals against the Amalekite sheep and animals? You brought them with you, the Jewish sheep, that they should kill the Amalekite sheep? I mean, it's kind of teasing them, right? He says, I don't understand. So then Saul starts to come up with, you know, excuse after excuse, and then Agag is alive. Unbeknownst to anyone, including Saul or Samuel themselves, Agag, either with his wife or a concubine, a girl that's brought to him, he does the Puravu thing. He has a child. She's not pregnant yet. God knows this. So he's able to pass on his lineage. He's not dead. And in fact, when Samuel finally comes and looks at him and says, you piece of garbage, you're dead now, and he realizes he's dead. But he says, you know what? The pain of death is not so brutal anymore. You can't do anything to me. Essentially saying, I've carried on my line. Kill me now, but I'll get you later. Right? And so he cuts him in half. Doesn't matter, because Agag has carried on his seed. So by connecting Agagite, we understand that it's directly related to the story of Saul, Samuel, and the failure of King Saul. And of course, what's more remarkable is that Esther and Mordechai are direct descendants of, can you guess? King Saul. So this multi-generational story, it's awesome. You have King Saul, the failure, Agag, almost like teasing Samuel and Saul. But then generations later, it's not lost. God says, it's okay. It's okay, Saul. I love you. You were a great man at one time. We're going to hold out hope. You have hope yet. Your great-granddaughter and great-great-grandson, Mordechai and Esther, they're going to be in the bag for you. They can save the day. And it'll be through them that the miracle will happen. And that is why, perhaps, some say that when Mordechai sends the letter to Esther, who's not willing to go to see the king because she's worried about losing her life, he said, Atu beit avich tavedu. It won't just be your loss. It's going to be your beit avich, the house of your father, will be lost. What do you mean, the house of my father? Saul. The neshama is waiting. The soul of Saul is waiting right now. You need to go, my dear. Right? So it's a profound idea to say to Esther. Can you imagine at that moment? It's not just you. Your great Zadie is waiting for you to do this, to undo the one thing that he can't undo in heaven. You need to do this. Go. If it's done somewhere else, it won't come through you. Then it won't be to the benefit of his neshama, his soul, to Saul's neshama. So you got to go. So that's one aspect I think is amazing. The last aspect of Haman, I think that's very profound, is his seeing Mordechai, and Mordechai doesn't bow. And there's reasons that we're not going to go in there a little bit outside of our scope tonight, but you know, the question you have to ask is, okay, there's an official edict of the king, yes. So how come Mordechai gets away with it day after day? How come not off with the head of Mordechai, and then we don't need to worry about killing all the Jews, right? Simplest explanation. Why not? Yeah. What prevented Haman from just saying, you transgressed the law of the king. You were warned already by all the other guys. Got to bow. He didn't bow, right? So why not? So there are reasons for this. But here's the germane point, I think, tonight, to leave us with tonight, to go forward. Haman is pathological. He is literally the grandfather of Adolf Hitler, Mashma. Okay? I mean, whether it's genetically, you know, DNA, we don't care. Same thing. What do I mean by this? Well, think about it for a moment. If you sit down with a reasonable guy, like the generals did with Hitler and Mashma, and say, wait a minute, you know, we're in jeopardy if we're fighting a multi-front war, and we have a lot of troops that are not really coming back alive, and we're really overextended. How about we leave the Jewish situation, the final solution for, like, I don't know, let's wait 10 years until we solidify the Third Reich. No. 1942, right, he's already losing. 1942, the Russians are destroying him, Americans are coming in, and he gets there at the Wannsee Conference, right? You know the history. He's there with Heydrich, Yimach Shemo, and Himmler, and he's saying, no, we've got to take all this massive manpower, massive effort, got to exterminate the Jews. It's insane, no? When you're fighting Russia and England, America, right? And you're worried about the Jews, why? Well, just wait! No. This is Haman, though, okay? Because we're going to see, and we'll discuss this in the next class, Haman walks out. The greatest moment in his life, he has the edict, the letter has been dispatched. Kill the Jews next Adar 13. Done deal. You can never take back an edict from the king, an official royal stationery. Okay? Postage rates went up, that's it, it's gone. Okay. And he has been just promoted to the highest title in the land other than the king. The queen apparently loves him because the only person other than the king who's invited to this private little party is Haman, done specifically by Queen Esther to try to bring, maybe there is a relationship going on with the queen and Haman, and if she can't get him one way, maybe, you know, an adulterous queen and Haman are both killed. That's one way that you can get him down. So that's done deliberately. So Haman's thinking, gee, you know, when I get rid of that idiot Ahasuerus, get rid of this ugly Zeresh, my wife, I'm going to have the lovely, gracious Esther because she already has the hots for me. She loves me already. Clearly, I'm the only one invited. So he's coming out at this moment of ultimate power and conquest, right? It's just a matter of what? Waiting a few months. The Mordechai problem, the Jewish problem, gone, right? It's all resolved. No. He sees Mordechai. And what does Mordechai not do? He doesn't get up and bow. And he goes ballistic. And he goes home that night and he says to his wife, Hakol, this is Hitler, Yimach Shemo. Hakol zeh eino shaveh li. None of this matters to me. The wealth, the grandeur, everything I have achieved in my life. It's a big fat Coke Zero. It's a nothing. Epes. As long as that Mordechai the Jew is alive and he won't bow, nothing means anything to me in this world. But Haman, the loved ones should say, which they don't, Baruch Hashem, you know, for us. They should say, but Haman, think of all the one, and he tells them all the wonderful things he can do. And they say, okay, stop, right? Think of how wonderful it is. No, he can't see that. All he sees is, I want a plan. I have to kill Mordecai. I want him dead. He's like, you know, it's like the godfather gets up there on the table. He's banging the table. I want him dead, deader and deader. I want him now, right? But there's no rhyme or reason. And it kills him. It's all gone by that moment. He doesn't understand. His wife is the one who warns him, right? Once you start to fall against the Jews, you're never going to get picked up again. Yeah, exactly. It's gone. But he can't see it. So it's like his own generals, like Lamashal, right, as a parable, are telling him, you're insane. Don't do this. And he can't. He can't prevent himself. So that's the pathology. That's the Amalekite. And that's why I say that two things are very powerfully interwoven. That the Amalekite vision to attack the Jew at any cost, and this is the last thing we'll share. It's a midrash, a famous, you know, like a chazal that's brought down where there's a boat traveling along. You may have heard the story. You know, it's not a real story, but it's done as a parable. And everybody on the boat, you know, has rented their rooms, beautiful, luxurious, you know, compartments. And they hear a drilling sound from one of the compartments. They go in, and there's a guy drilling a hole to the bottom of the vessel. And they go, wait, whoa, the captain, you know, knocks on the door. What are you doing in there? You're insane. The guards come, they knock the door down. The guy's sitting there drilling him with a little triangle hat. And they say, are you crazy? What are you doing? He says, my room, get out of here. But you're going to, he says, I'm drilling through the bottom of the boat. But you're going to kill everybody. You're going to die too. He says, well, tell me, is Mordecai on the ship? Yeah, of course. No problem. He smiles and continues drilling. But that's the whole point, is that if Mordecai's on the ship and the ship's going down, I'm perfectly okay. And that's really, he says this out loud. All the money in the world, all the position in the world, if I have to go down with the ship, as long as Mordecai is going down, I'm there. And this is the mindset of the Amalekite, and we'll discuss it further in weeks to come. I wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom.